Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. I am Mike Havakin, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority, as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning, I'm William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Pafik, good morning.
And John Freidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court, and I will state what is probably obvious. Justice Miller Lerman, who is actually the longest serving member of the court, is recused on this particular case, on the first case of the day. And with that, counsel, the first case of the day is Choice Homes LLC versus Donner. And you may take your places at your respective tables. And Mr. Blanc.
Your Honor, actually, I'll be arguing.
Okay, Mr. Ruge.
Yes.
Good morning to you. And is it Mr. Bierman?
That's right.
Good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Then, Mr. Ruge, you may approach and you may proceed.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. My name is Doug Ruge. I'm representing the appellant, Choice Homes. The crux of this case is an issue over whether a real estate license is needed in certain transactions. In this particular case, the facts were that a builder had an arrangement with an owner of some real estate. This is not an unusual situation where builders locate properties, whether they be lots or existing homes. They reach an arrangement with the owner of the property, and then they present that property to clients of theirs, people that are interested in building or developing the property. That happened in this case. The defendants in this particular case were introduced to the property by the builder. The builder then, pursuant to the prior agreement with the owner of the property, entered into a purchase agreement.
Perhaps you could identify what you believe your client's real estate interest stemmed from. How did it acquire an interest, and when did it do so?
So at the outset, there was an arrangement, a verbal arrangement between the owner of the property and the builder.
And consequently, the statute of frauds would apply to that?
There may be a part performance exception in that particular case.
So what is your understanding of what your clients are claiming their ownership interest was?
I think the focus is at the time that there was a breach. And at that time, there was an agreement entered into between the owner of the property and the plaintiff and the builder and the buyers of the ultimate buyers of this property. So I would say that the ultimate agreement at that point is the rights that existed at that point stem from the purchase agreements, Your Honor.
So you're not claiming that your client had acquired an actual ownership interest prior to the signing of the written purchase agreement?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I believe that the focus is at the time of the breach, which is there at that time there are agreements, but
well, there are activities before then that your client was seeking some form of compensation for, weren't there?
There were activities, right? There would have been no agreement for compensation at that point. The agreement for compensation arose in the purchase agreement by virtue of the $70,000 for compensation for the building of the home. And then obviously there would be money for the difference in purchase price between the two contracts.
If one disregards the purported oral agreement, how long of a period of time did your client actually have an ownership interest?
If I understand your question, Your Honor,
In other words, you're relying solely upon the written purchase agreements.
Right.
You have, within 24 hours, you acquire the real estate and then enter into an agreement to sell it, correct?
That is true. I believe...
So your client only had, to the extent that those create an equitable ownership interest in the real estate, that existed only for 24 hours, right?
I would characterize it this way, Your Honor. The purchase agreements were executed almost simultaneously. And then the transaction moved forward. So to the extent that the transaction moved forward from that point, I would say that the interest in the property existed for a long period of time.
Your client never acquired legal title, right?
That is true.
So you're relying solely on equitable title.
That is true, Your Honor.
And the equitable title that your client acquired would have passed on as soon as your client signed the agreement to sell it to the buyers that ultimately ended up not buying it, right?
So the way I look at it, Your Honor, there were two purchase agreements, one between my client, the builder, right, and then the ultimate buyers of the property, and then the owners of the property that had legal title to the property. So I don't see that you have two purchase agreements. I don't see that the interest disappears. Am I understanding correctly?
Well, doesn't it pass? You're relying on the rule that equitable title passes upon the execution of a real estate purchase agreement, aren't you?
Yes, I believe that that's true.
And that rule would apply to both transactions. It would apply to when your client acquired it, and it would apply to when they entered into the transaction to sell it.
So you're saying that there would be equitable title with my client by virtue of both purchase agreements?
No, I'm assuming that you did acquire equitable title by the first purchase agreement.
Okay.
But didn't you lose equitable title by virtue of the second purchase agreement, which was almost instantaneously?
You're saying by executing title with the legal title holder that somehow obviated the legal title with the ultimate buyer?
I'm just asking what your real estate interest is. You agree that you never acquired legal title. So it has to be equitable title.
Right.
And isn't it, if you turn around and sell it, your client turns around and sells it, doesn't the equitable title pass at that moment to the buyer in the ultimate buyer?
So, yes. I mean, what you're saying is that if when it closes,
you're relying on the first purchase agreement never closed, right? So you're not relying on closing as the date for transfer of equitable title, are you?
No, not for closing, no.
So it has to be when you sign the purchase agreement.
Right.
And then when the second purchase agreement is signed, the equitable title passes to...
I see what you're saying. You're saying that when the second purchase agreement was signed with the... I think the, actually the order was that the purchase agreement was signed with the owners, and then the purchase agreement was signed with the ultimate purchasers. But to answer your question, did legal title pass from the ultimate owners to the legal title holders?
Well, legal title never passed to anybody, did it?
I'm just talking in the abstract. No, it didn't.
Right.
I'm just talking about them being legal title holders.
Okay.
But
I've used a lot of your time, but I do have one more question.
Sure.
As I look at the record, I cannot find any indication that Mr. Gilman was identified by your client as a party representative and deposed in that capacity. Is there something in the record that I've overlooked?
Yes, Your Honor. There, for example, his affidavit states that he is an owner of Choice Homes.
Now, what I'm asking about, there's the discovery rule that permits someone suing an entity to require the entity to designate someone to be deposed. That's the rule I'm talking about. I can't find anything in the record that suggests that that rule was invoked. Have I missed something?
I can't remember what the notice of deposition stated. There is discussion in the deposition, as I recall, of him being an owner, and discussion of him working on this transaction as the owner on behalf of Choice Homes.
Okay. Well, your clients argued in brief that Mr. Gilman is not a party for purposes of the Momsen rule, right?
I would state that my emphasis on the Momsen is one that he did not contradict anything that was produced or said prior. And to the extent that the court was relying on pleadings, pleadings are not something that's under oath.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bierman, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is William Bierman. I'm here today representing the defendant appellees, Ms. Heidi Donner individually, as well as her capacity as a personal representative of her late husband's estate. But we're seeking a full affirmance of Judge Stratman's order, granted summary judgment in favor of my clients. But one thing I want to be clear about that order is that there were separate independent reasons for granting summary judgment. So in order to actually overturn the disposition of that summary judgment order, the appellant today would need to string together a series of errors or a series of reversals in order to actually create the chain to overturn the actual grant of summary judgment in my client's favor. So for example, as to the real estate transaction, which we consider to be a scam real estate transaction, there needed to be a real estate license in place, yes, but also the other claims that have been raised here, like tortious interference. The district court did a very good job of walking through mechanically in terms of all the other various issues with those claims that are based on this $620,000, way we've described it as sort of an A to B and B to C transaction. But based on the court's recent questioning of the appellant, I think the court understands the basic facts that the A to B and B to C transactions were not really appropriately separated. So, for example, we believe those two purchase agreements were signed a few hours apart. They were signed on the same day and set for closing for both on or before October 31, so really set to close at the same time as well.
Is there something wrong with that?
Well, in this case, there is something wrong with that. Okay. Because leading up to the execution of both purchase agreements, which occurred on September 7, Choice Homes was engaged in real estate broker activity.
So that's what's wrong with it.
That's what's wrong with it.
Not the fact that you have a purchase agreement and another purchase agreement and then closing on the same day 30 days later.
Well, there might be something wrong with that, but we don't raise a particular issue related to that order. But, you know, one thing that didn't happen here is my client wasn't given title paperwork. And I think it makes it a little complicated as to how those two transactions would have both closed at the same time.
What about this makes Mr. Gilman or Choice Homes a broker?
So again, the chronology is very important. So leading up to that September 7 day where both purchase agreements were signed, Choice Homes through Jason Gilman showed my clients the Parso property when Choice Homes did not own it and, in fact, did not have a purchase agreement for it yet. In addition to showing the property, there were text messages back and forth where Mr. Gilman made affirmative representations about the state of the property. My clients had questions about the soil, and Mr. Gilman answered them. He didn't say, you know, let me check with the owner. He made affirmative representations about the soil in an attempt to get my client to move forward with the transaction. So certainly showing the property, making representations about it, negotiating the deal, putting the deal together, all that conduct is within our statutory definition of real estate broker conduct. The district court, again, did a very good job of going through these things, but I think it's particularly relevant here that Choice Homes' position on the seller property disclosure statement is that Choice Homes took the seller property disclosure statement from the Parsos and handed it over to my client. Again, it's something that a realtor would do, something that a broker would do. Take the form filled out by the actual owner and hand it over to the designed end purchaser.
So is that something a builder can't do?
Well, Choice Homes could have done it here if they would have had a real estate license. But because they don't, it renders their desire to seek $620,000 from my client in court unenforceable by statute. The district court's focus on this first piece was not necessarily that the conduct is wrongful, although we would certainly take the position that there was a lot of wrongful activity that happened here. But the legal focus is that without a real estate license, Choice Homes can't go to the district court and ask for an award of $620,000 because that's an attempt to be compensated for unlicensed broker activity. Something that hasn't come up yet today is that there's also a separate claim for defamation. We want to be clear that the defamation piece is sort of a separate transaction or occurrence. It's dealt with separately by the district court. Happened a few months after this real estate transaction sort of fell apart. But the defamation analysis provided by the district court was also appropriate and should also be affirmed in all respects. The defamation allegations at issue here involve actually kind of a long Google review. The Google review has, I think, 8 or 10 sentences in it. But walking through each of the separate sentences, I think the court can see we have some non-controversial, true factual statements about, you know, that these two gentlemen were friends and that the folks involved lived together, lived next to each other. No one's taking issue with those. I don't think anyone's saying those statements aren't true. And then when you get to the controversial statements, like this person isn't trustworthy, he's trying to sue me, things like that, those statements are just Ms. Donner's opinion. And so when you have a defamation claim based on undisputedly non-controversial true facts combined with opinion, it simply doesn't create a cause of action for defamation under our state's governing case law.
Counsel, I perhaps heard my question to your opponent about the designation of a party representative for choice for purposes of deposition. I can't find anything in the record that suggests that your client invoked the discovery rule that would have required choice to designate someone. Is there anything in the record that speaks to that?
No, there's not. And in fact, we would concede that at his deposition, he was appearing in his personal fact witness capacity and not as a 30B6 discovery representative for the corporation. And, you know, we've noted that on appeal now, the appellants have raised some of the cases interpreting Momsen, indicating that the rule applies differently with non-party witnesses, perhaps doesn't apply at all to non-party witnesses. And our response to that is really twofold. For one, the court doesn't really need to address that today, because if you read the district court's order closely, you'll see that the district court district court also held that even if one does consider the Gilman affidavit, and even if one does not discard it as a matter of law, In other words, whether the Monson rule is applied in this case or not, Choice Homes can't use the protection of the for sale by owner exception. Again, because of their limitations on trying to use this equitable title rule, the statute of frauds, there's just other problems with it. So I don't know if I'd characterize it as a harmless error, but it's not an error that necessarily makes a legal difference to the outcome of this case. But the other piece would be that it may be appropriate for this court to revisit the prior precedent regarding Monson and non-parties. I think the non-party Monson cases are about nurses and very large hospitals, and it might make sense to say that a nurse of a 1,000-employee hospital shouldn't be able to find the hospital. But from our perspective, Jason Gilman did provide contradictory statements on the record in this case, and to say that we can't hold Choice Homes to account for those contradictory statements didn't seem fair to us. We certainly didn't appreciate moving for summary judgment on the licensure issue and then being told that, oh, actually, we had an agreement with Alan Parso dating back to whenever. That had never been revealed to us in discovery before that time. We think that contradicts the deposition testimony, and we wanted to raise the Monson point to the district court. I think the district court understood our point, that it's really not fair to counter a summary judgment motion and attempt to drum up an issue of fact on something that contradicts prior sworn statements.
Why should we treat Mr. Gilman as a party when your client did not invoke the discovery rule to require Choice to designate him as such?
Because he's a 50% owner and the operator and really the only fact witness on behalf of Choice Homes relevant to this case. And again, though, we think that the court can really avoid addressing the Monson right. piece today because Choice Homes was not an owner for the purpose of the exception, really under anybody's sets of facts here.
Of course, there's another 50% owner in this case of Choice, and in another case, which of course is what we would be looking to, there might be multiple owners, and how does one know without a 30B6 designation who should be the party's designated witness?
I think that's a fair point. So again, we would probably just revert more to the argument that
to the alternative.
You can sort of get there without needing to address the Monson stuff today. And in any event, I think it was appropriate for the district court to not really like that there was a changed story being presented in the face of a motion for summary judgment. So again, we have a record of clear broker activity. We think that if the court simply reads the plain language of the exception statute, this court will see that the for sale by owner exceptions just simply does not apply in this case, and therefore it bars all of Choice Homes' requests for $620,000 from my client in this case. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes oral arguments in Choice Homes LLC versus Donner. Counsel, you are excused, and the court